My name is Marius Smith and I'm the manager of the Katherine Centre for Human Rights Law here at Monash. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet tonight, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. And before getting started, I'd like to note that, of course, it is Reconciliation Week, a week which seems to be in the news for all the wrong reasons. But we are at the Katherine Centre commemorating the week, and we have a series of guest blog posts on our blog, which is katherinecentre.com, and it'd be great if you all check them out. They're really good. Reconciliation Week runs from the anniversary of the successful 1967 referendum through to the anniversary of the 1992 Mabo case, but we meet tonight to discuss an altogether more depressing anniversary, the 10th anniversary of the beginning of the Darfur War. As most of you would know, the Darfur War in the northwestern part of Sudan started to heat up just as the southern rebels, the SPLA, were making peace with the government of Sudan to end the war in the south. The government was able to deploy resources and, more importantly, the skills that it learned in the south in its proxy war that it subsequently waged in Darfur. In 2002, I arrived on the other side of the country to work on an aid program in East Sudan. It was the usual African fiasco. Eritrea supported the southern rebels, the SPLA, to push across and open up a new rebel-held enclave in East Sudan. The muscle was provided by the SPLA, while the intellect was provided by the northern opposition groups, but it could mostly be described as a bunch of beret-wearing coffee drinkers. But the government in the East was never able to sow the ethnic unrest that it did in the south and in Darfur, mainly because the area was more ethnically homogenous. But while I was there, we started to hear whispers about what was happening in the West, mostly thanks to former Darfuri rebel group members who were working in the area. We knew what the GRS was capable of, but we didn't think that the government would unleash violence quite on the scale that it subsequently did. Darfur was initially waged in the shadow of the Iraq War and its aftermath, but it would be wrong to suggest that Darfur has not received any publicity and attention over the years, much of it due to the efforts of aid activists, human rights groups and even the odd movie star. That's why on the 10th anniversary of the war in Darfur, it's vital that activists continue to keep the spotlight on the region as we wait for a durable peace, and hope that the recent Doha conference, with its pledge of billions of dollars of aid for reconstruction, will be more than just another mirage. Tonight we're privileged to host three very impressive speakers, the third of who will be here shortly. And I'm pleased that we'll all have plenty of time to ask questions at the end. So without further ado, please welcome the President and Chair of the Darfur Australia Network, Sandra Chestnut, to open tonight's proceedings.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We are delighted this evening to partner with the Katherine Centre for Human Rights and the Sudan Peace Project to present the Sudan 10 Years After Speaking Forum. This year, the Darfur Australia Network, or DAN as we call it, marks the 10th anniversary of the Darfur conflict. Available data indicates that since 2007, more than 1.3 million people have been newly displaced in Darfur, and the number has grown massively and consistently every year during this period. Over the last 10 years, the world has witnessed 300,000 die as a result of a direct attack and conflict-related malnutrition and disease, with the vast majority of the affected being the women, children and civilian men. Although parts of Darfur have become more peaceful since 2009, the crisis is ongoing, with hundreds of thousands of people still being displaced, and an increasingly volatile situation in the face of renewed conflict between Sudan and South Sudan, and the border issues in the Blue Nile and South Kordofan. The humanitarian and economic situation of the people still in Darfur continues to deteriorate. Darfur still faces genocide by attrition and the downward spiral of human security. A personal reflection on my time in South Darfur from July 2010 until November 2012. The issues affecting the people of Darfur are reflected in the needs for basic services delivered by INGOs and NGOs due to the fact the government provides little funding for basic needs. Over the past 2.5 years, whilst living in Niala, which is the capital of South Darfur, I managed and coordinated the Merlin Medical Relief for South Darfur primary health programs. And this program delivered primary health programs to host communities throughout South Darfur and IDPs living in Kalma camp and in Baba Nusa and Old camp in Gereda. Without Merlin's intervention, hundreds of thousands of people throughout South Darfur would not receive even the most basic of health services. And this lack of basic health services, this lack of basic services, not only health, is reflected throughout South Darfur and all across Darfur. The security situation in Darfur at the best of times is unpredictable. And since my departure in Niala, increased rebel movements has resulted in the closure of two of Merlin clinics in Margarine and in Mgunya. And bombing has been reported near Majuria, and that's near Labado and Yassin, and that was a few weeks ago. The general decline of security continues with daily reports throughout Darfur of road banditry, carjacking, abductions, shootings, killings, and robbery are just some of the security issues faced by the Darfurian people every day. And that's not to mention, as I said earlier, the ongoing conflict that rages every day throughout Darfur. So who is DAN? Who is the Darfur Australian Network? Well, in May 2006, a group of very keen Darfurian community members and passionate volunteers in Melbourne set up the Darfur Australian Network, or DAN. DAN's focus was to raise its voice on the conflict in Darfur. DAN provides an important vehicle that has made it possible for the wider Darfur community in Australia to have a say on these issues, on the issues affecting Darfur, and in turn, on the peace process. DAN is a small, non-for-profit, volunteer-based organisation run by members of the Melbourne and Sydney-based Darfur communities and interested individuals from the broader community, all of whom share a common passion for protecting people's basic rights and wanting to help those affected by the conflict in Darfur. Since its establishment, DAN has undertaken an extensive range of successful awareness raising and advocacy activities through a base of skilled and motivated volunteers. And as a direct result, DAN has become the most visible organisation in Australia focusing solely on Darfur. DAN operates under the philosophy which sees the Darfur community in Australia working together and standing as one voice. The Darfur community can most effectively communicate the message about the continued crisis in Darfur, advocating to the Australian government, the UN, and other international bodies, and advancing the overall quest for peace. DAN works to build and foster an inclusive dialogue for sustainable peace, believing that despite the horrors of war, peace is always possible in Darfur. DAN's work to date has led to a series of achievements. DAN has held numerous events, including local rallies, in conjunction with a global awareness effort, helping build political momentum on the issue of Darfur, holding a photography exhibition in central Melbourne, Sydney and Canberra, and the striking Forgotten People knotted fabric creative exhibitions in Melbourne and Sydney, both attracting widespread interest and media coverage. And you can see some of our knotted fabric out there on our presentation when you came in today. Dan's strategy of engaging directly with media organisations and providing Darfuri spokesmen to them has seen significant media attention given to the Darfur crisis, with Darfur members participating in public discussions around the crisis, particularly coinciding with the peak of the Darfuri conflict between 2006 to 2010. The media has provided local, national and regional press coverage of Dan's events and opinion editorials and blogs published on national media. More recently, Dan has been involved in peace-building training with Darfur communities in Melbourne and Sydney, and we hope to conduct more training before the end of the year. Dan's role as an advocate organisation, by engaging with the Darfuri community members and establishing aid organisations, Dan plays an important role as an advocate to the Australian government agencies, politicians and other international bodies responsible for appropriate policy responses regarding the Darfuri crisis and the process of meaningful peace negotiations. We'll actually be having a trip to Canberra next month to actually meet with politicians to discuss the Darfuri crisis. Where are we going? We're moving forward. Strengthening Dan's future communications and networks throughout Australia is a priority. Dan plans to undertake a community mapping program. We'll be conducting community consultations, some we've already had, and we'll bring together the leaders of the Darfuri communities nationwide to work towards a more financial sustainable model of advocacy of the organisation so we can meet our focus. In the meantime, a small yet highly dedicated group that makes up Darfur Australia Network continues to keep working step by step, resolutely finding ways to continue speaking out about the ongoing crisis and crimes against humanity and in Darfur and Sudan as a whole. We invite and welcome your support for Dan. There's a number of ways you can help. You may be interested in sharing your skills and talents as a volunteer. And if so, go to our website, which is www.darfuraustralia.org, and register your interest. We have here this evening have a number of our very dedicated volunteers who helped make this evening possible. We've also outside, we've got a sign-up sheet to receive our newsletter and other notices. Our website has currently been updated, and we intend to be keeping it updated. I would invite you to become a friend of Darfur, of Dan, and pledge your financial support for the various programs we undertake. You can make a donation this evening, buy some of our merchandise which is outside, or there is paperwork there that you can pledge your support on a regular basis. Please, I welcome you to assist us. That's me for the evening, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the evening, and I welcome our speaker. Are you going to be introducing our speakers? It's my great pleasure to welcome Professor Alex Bellamy to speak on this subject.
Well, thanks very much, and I stand up knowing with some pain that I'm actually the least qualified person sitting at this table to speak on this subject, but that's never stopped me before, so I won't let it stop me this time. It's with a mixture of pleasure and sadness that I come here. Pleasure in that it's a delight to be working again with the good people of Dan. I remember 6-7 years ago we were working together and trying to persuade the Australian government to contribute to the UNAU mission to Darfur with, let's say, moderate levels of success. And nice to see that they've all aged much better than I have as well. But it's also with profound sadness in that this topic of 10 years on, one might have hoped that I could have come to talk about rebuilding, reconstruction, the emergence of stable peace in Darfur, as opposed to the actual subject tonight, which is a resurgent conflict, renewed displacement, and more crimes and problems. Many years ago, the former Secretary General of the UN, Kofi Annan, I think summed up the international response to the crisis in Darfur very nicely when he said, "We were slow, hesitant, uncaring, and we have learned nothing from Darfur." We all know the statistics of the war in Darfur. Between 180,000 and 450,000 people have died as a result of the war, most of them civilians. Of that, somewhere between 36,000 and 90,000 civilians were intentionally killed by violence. Between 2.5 and 3.5 million people have been displaced, and about 1.4 million people remain displaced, having been displaced now for almost a decade. There has been widespread and systematic sexual and gender-based violence, and 47 of the UNAU peacekeepers sent to police the peace in Darfur have died violent deaths there. And all of this in an era of the responsibility to protect. In 2005, all the world governments came together in New York to agree on this principle of responsibility to protect. It said three very simple things. Firstly, that all states have a responsibility to protect their own citizens from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity. Secondly, that the international community should work together to assist states to fulfill that responsibility. And thirdly, when states were manifestly failing in their responsibility to protect, the international community, working through the United Nations, had a responsibility to take timely and decisive action. Clearly, that didn't happen in the case of Darfur. And it's not because the responsibility to protect is just idle words. The principle has been reaffirmed twice since 2005 by the UN Security Council in 2006 and 2009, both times unanimously. It's also been explicitly used by the Council itself in relation to the crisis in Darfur, in Resolution 1706, crises in Cote d'Ivoire, Libya, Yemen, South Sudan, the Great Lakes region, and most recently in Mali. So not only, though, is this a historic problem going back to 2003 for the anniversary we're marking tonight, but the situation today is at least as unstable as it was those years ago, and certainly more unstable than it was 12 months ago or 2 years ago. We've heard a talk already about the second version of the Darfur Peace Agreement agreed in Doha in 2011 between the government of Sudan and one of the rebel groups, the Liberation and Justice Movement, a coalition of about 10 other groups. Three other rebel groups decided not to be part of that process, and since Doha we've seen a slow unravelling of the peace. 2013 has already seen a significant upsurge in violence, both inter-Arab fighting and renewed fighting between the government of Sudan and some of its militia proxies, and some of the rebel groups that were not party to the Doha agreement. Between 2010 and 2012, most of the fighting was in the east of Darfur, but they're now spreading back to the north. And since the beginning of this year, 300,000 civilians have been newly displaced. So that's people who weren't displaced this time last year, who are now displaced. And all of this is occurring in a broader global context of donor fatigue. The world is focused not on Darfur, but on crises in Syria and Mali, which have drawn resources away from Darfur. And of course, the global financial crisis means that the total global pot of resources available for this sort of work is getting smaller. What I want to do tonight is briefly talk about how the world responded to that crisis that started in 2003. But after arriving, I discovered that the good people of Dan have already done that work for me, and much better than I'm going to do it. So I'll go through that very, very quickly. Then I'll explain briefly why I think the world failed so badly in its responsibility to protect the people of Darfur, reflect briefly on the situation there today, and suggest some lessons that we might learn from this sorry episode and how we might do better next time. A brief summary, I think, as I say, Kofi Annan summed it up well, but the response was slow, hesitant, and uncoordinated. Between 2003 and 2005, at the height of the violence, there was very little response at all. Post-2005, the international response was focused on creating the conditions for getting a peacekeeping mission into Darfur, irrespective of whether or not peacekeeping was the right response to the crisis. Also, popular debate about Darfur became a little bit sidetracked, in my view, by the whole question of whether what was happening there was genocide or not. There was this great moment when the US Congress and senior US officials declared that it was genocide, and then the big nothing afterwards. The whole response also raises questions about the appropriateness of various international protection tools. But one high point, I think, of the international response to Darfur is that after a slow start, the international humanitarian effort was nothing short of remarkable, both in terms of its scale — it was one of the largest humanitarian efforts the world has ever seen — but also in terms of its coordination. And there are literally millions of people alive today because of that humanitarian effort that wouldn't have been alive without it. But one of the reasons why the death toll may seem a little low, given that we were hearing 10 years ago predictions of 250,000-300,000 people being killed, is because of that humanitarian effort, which primarily gave people a place to escape to. So how did the world respond? Well, as we know, the fighting erupted around March 2003, though violence had escalated gradually in the year or two prior to that. And in mid-2004, the government responded to an armed rebellion in Darfur with a massive campaign of violence and ethnic cleansing. So it's important to stress that the peak of the violence was in those first 12 to 18 months. And it was precisely in those first 12 to 18 months where there was very little international presence on the ground and almost no international response. It was in late 2003 that Jan Egeland, the UN's human rights coordinator, described Darfur as one of the world's worst humanitarian catastrophes, and the news media and politicians immediately reached for their maps of Africa to find where Darfur was, because they were largely unaware. And I know of some governments where that was literally the case, of people having to brief ministers and showing them on the map where Darfur was. Jan Egeland was very calculated in stating what he did and the way he did in order to draw attention of a crisis in Darfur. But that was in late 2003, at least 6 months into the major crisis. The major humanitarian operation began in earnest in early 2004, and in spring 2004, the AU and EU brokered a ceasefire that would be monitored by AMIS, the African Union mission in Sudan, which was at that point a small monitoring mission deployed to monitor a ceasefire that neither party intended on keeping. In July 2004, many of you will remember that whole big debate about genocide and the US Congress passing a statement describing the situation there as genocide. But again, nothing very much happened as a result. Later that month, the Security Council passed its first resolution. So in July 2004, more than a year after the crisis began, the Security Council passed its first resolution, which demanded the disarmament of the Janjaweed militia, those notorious government proxies who were responsible for most of the violence and ethnic cleansing in Darfur, within 30 days, and imposed an arms embargo on those militia. At the same time, there was a big push to negotiate a settlement, but the negotiations were clearly going nowhere. Neither side seemed to be negotiating in good faith. Both sides had all sorts of caveats and conditions, and it was clear that nothing that was being talked about in the negotiations was translating into realities on the ground, where the violence was proceeding apace. The Secretary General reported back to the Security Council that the government of Sudan's compliance with Resolution 1556 was less than fulsome. There had been almost no disarming of the Janjaweed, and certainly no evidence of an embargo on arms on them. And he called for a larger international presence to monitor that compliance, and for steps to be taken to put pressure on the government of Sudan to comply with its international obligations. After a lot of discussion and debate and arguing in the council, in September 2004, the council threatened sanctions on Sudanese oil if the government of Sudan failed to comply with the earlier resolutions or accept a larger African Union mission to monitor compliance. That resolution also established a commission of inquiry to investigate the claims of genocide in Darfur. Under this intense pressure, the government of Sudan eventually relented to some extent and agreed to a larger AU mission of about 4,500 soldiers. This was AMIS Mark II. Meanwhile, the peace talks in Abuja were still not going terribly well. The rebel groups themselves started fragmenting. Some of them stopped turning up to the meetings. Other new groups started wanting to join the talks. And this kind of allowed the government of Sudan to play along with the idea of participating in peace talks without actually having to make any concessions. Some people may see parallels with the upcoming Geneva process in relation to Syria. And now it gets really small, because lots happened. Meanwhile, on the ground in Darfur, the violence continued. The government of Sudan and its Janjaweed militia attacked IDP camps. Rebels responded with retaliatory strikes. There was agreement in late 2004 on a peace accord, or elements of a peace accord. A no-fly zone was agreed in rebel-held territories. And the government of Sudan agreed to unrestricted humanitarian access. But again, there are issues translating what was agreed around the negotiating table onto the ground. And humanitarian organizations reported that there was very little easing on the humanitarian access front. Violence continued to escalate, and then in early January 2005, the international inquiry that was tasked by the Security Council came down with a finding that although the government was clearly responsible in all likelihood for crimes against humanity, there was little direct evidence of genocide. At the same time, the council began considering plans for a larger peacekeeping force, but again, the council was deeply divided on a number of issues. Russia, China, and a few others were opposed to the idea of a force that didn't have Sudanese consent. The government of Sudan was very clear that it wasn't going to give its consent. And then there was a whole side issue of referring the matter to the International Criminal Court, where there the major obstacle was the United States, that was adamantly opposed to legitimizing the court by referring the situation there. So the council was largely deadlocked by these kind of complex issues, but it was able to do some strengthening of the arms embargo and move forward with contingency planning on peacekeeping. And I'll click forward. Eventually, the US relented on the ICC, basically because the Europeans threatened to block everything else that the US wanted to achieve on Darfur unless the US relented on the ICC. And facing strong pressure from Congress, the US administration decided to give ground on the ICC, but made a clear statement in relation to that resolution that it considered it in no way a precedent or in no way a signal of US support for the ICC. Once again, the violence, as we move into 2005-06, rises and falls. The US, now determined and under strong congressional pressure to find a solution, decides that peacekeeping is the response to the problem. But the question is how to create the conditions necessary for peacekeeping. And peacekeeping requires some sort of peace agreement for the peacekeepers to keep. So the US starts pushing for a peace agreement. It's not too worried about what sort of peace agreement, just so long as there is a peace agreement. And starts arguing the case for UN peacekeepers. The key problem at this point being that very few countries actually want to contribute troops. After a lot more debate and discussion and deadlock and conflict, the Security Council passes Resolution 1786, described as one of the Council's worst ever resolutions, in that it was a resolution authorising a peacekeeping mission that nobody intended to deploy, that the government of Sudan opposed, and that no member state of the United Nations was prepared to commit to. So it was back to the drawing board, and many months later the Council came back and passed Resolution 1769, which created this UN-AU hybrid mission. The compromise to the government of Sudan was that this would be a mission largely comprised of African peacekeepers. The compromise for the West was that this would be a mission tasked under Chapter 7 to do, amongst other things, protect civilians in Darfur. Meanwhile, of course, the ICC had been busy doing its investigative work, and in July 2008, Omar al-Bashir was indicted for genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. The government of Sudan responded by kicking out about 21 humanitarian organizations who were working in Darfur and creating their own immediate humanitarian crises that those organizations that remained had to scramble hard to fill. 2010-2011, we see that Doha negotiated an attempt to renegotiate the Darfur Peace Agreement, which was kind of a stillborn entity. And there was agreement, as I said earlier, between the government of Sudan and one organization around a degree of regional autonomy, a future referendum, and power sharing at the national level. But as I said, three of the key rebel groups from Darfur were not party to that agreement. And that's the core of the problem today. Now, since 2010, the situation in Darfur has dropped from the international agenda. You often see now labels of the forgotten conflict or the forgotten genocide. The government of Sudan's formal position is the armed conflict is over. Any violence left in Darfur is just criminal violence and should be treated as such. Some of the statements that come from the UNAMID leadership say fairly much the same thing. And it's true to say that from 2009 to 2012, there were significant improvements in the situation on the ground. But there was little, if any, progress towards resolving the key underlying conflicts, and the failure of Doha has started to unravel that temporary peace. Many parts of Darfur had become more peaceful as a result, others had not, and as I said, there are signs of escalation in different parts. And in 2013, some significant upsurges in violence. Some of the key changes, we've seen changes in the geography of conflict, shifting from the eastern parts of Darfur around the Chad border towards the western area bordering onto South Kordofan. And more recently, we've seen an increase in violence in the north, especially as the government of Sudan and some of its allied militia have started attacking some of those rebel groups that were not party to the Doha agreement. We've also seen a slight change in some of the actors. The government of Sudan is now using non-Arab proxies. So in particular some marginalised groups from within Darfur and other non-Arab groups. And we've seen a lot of intra-Arab fighting as well. And that was the key aspect of the violence between 2009 and 2012. And the result of this, as I mentioned earlier, has been a large upswing in violence and displacement in 2013. So although the dynamics have changed, the underlying trends the violence today are fairly similar to those of 10 and 9 years ago. The government of Sudan is still supplying and backing its proxies. Most of the anti-civilian violence is perpetrated by these proxies, supported sometimes by government of Sudan forces and the Air Force. The international presence there, although larger than it was 10 years ago, has not effectively impeded the government of Sudan and its proxies. The rebel groups remain divided, and many of those groups are not committed to a political settlement. And the rebel groups have abandoned much of the territory they once held. They have lost some of their key external backers, like the governments of Libya, Chad, and South Sudan. And so some of the underlying dynamics are starting to change. In terms of the current issues of concern, the key things, well, I mentioned before, the significant and long-term displacement, and the very fact that 1.4 million people remain displaced and have little likelihood of returning home anytime soon. This recent recurrent upsurge of violence suggests that the underlying causes of the conflict have not been resolved and that there is further prospects for escalation. There has been persistent high rates of sexual and gender-based violence that has proven immune to the various programs put in place to tackle that. We've seen the recruitment of new proxies by the government of Sudan to fight its battles in various parts of Sudan. We've seen renewed fighting between the government of Sudan and its enemies. We've seen a continual flow of weapons and ammunition into the region despite the Security Council's arms embargo. And aerial bombardment persists. Every region of Darfur has experienced aerial bombardment in the last 2 years, despite clear demands that such things stop and denials from the government of Sudan. Why did the world fail so badly? I think there are three clusters of reasons, and I've talked for way too long, so I'll end with this bit and then jump to the conclusions. There are three clusters of reasons, I think, why the world failed Darfur so badly. The first is to do with international politics. Early in the peace, there was a conscious decision amongst some governments to prioritise the peace agreement between the North and the South, the government of Sudan and the FPLA, and there was a sense that going in too hard on the government of Sudan in relation to Darfur would scare them off the comprehensive peace agreement between the North and the South. So there was a conscious decision to prioritise peace in one part of Sudan over that in another part. Secondly, the Security Council was badly divided on a whole host of issues. Many members of the Council opposed any sort of coercion against the government of Sudan. The US was opposed to the ICC, and the Council was weak and divided on this issue. And we know when the Council is weak and divided, it tends not to be the most effective responder to atrocity crimes. Thirdly, governments with the capacity to contribute resources lack the political will to do so. The West was involved with Iraq and Afghanistan at the time, and there was certainly little stomach for getting involved in another major commitment. At the same time, of course, the US was prosecuting its global war on terror, and the government in Khartoum was proving to be quite a helpful source of information in relation to the war on terror. So there were elements certainly within the US government that had their own interests in not pushing the government of Sudan too hard. China and Russia, of course, had their own significant material interests that we all know about. And the AU itself was also badly divided, so the region wasn't speaking with one voice either, which certainly made it easier for the rest of the world to not take decisive action. Rwanda wanted to take a proactive approach to protection, but other states, including Nigeria, Egypt, Libya, wanted an exclusively African solution and were much better disposed towards the government of Sudan position. So through all of that, there was a kind of a consensus that the government of Sudan was a crucial player and that its consent was critical to any international steps. And there was deep reticence about putting any sort of pressure on the government of Sudan. The other set of issues is that the responsibility to protect was itself not institutionalized. In fact, that agreement that I talked about didn't come about until 2 years into the situation in Darfur, and progress on implementing that agreement was hesitant and slow at the beginning. So there was very little early warning. It was weak and non-existent. There were very few agencies on the ground at the start of the crisis. Getting clear analysis about what was going on was difficult, and there was lots of differing opinions. There was a limited flow of assessment and information. And ultimately, and this is a finding that the UN found in relation to its response to the crisis in Sri Lanka 6 years later, there was no organization that assumed responsibility for the protection of people in Darfur. So there were humanitarian agencies with their humanitarian role to provide services and care for the vital needs of the populations in Darfur, but no agency took responsibility for protecting the civilians of Darfur. The result was this slow and hesitant reaction. And then there's a third set, which is that the situation in Darfur itself was quite difficult and complicated. The conflict itself is complex, has many different roots and sources. The specifics of local conflict differ from region to region, and they include long-standing conflicts over territory, grazing rights, water, other things. There are multiple armed groups, and as the crisis escalated, the number of armed groups proliferated, making conflict resolution that much more difficult. The opposition itself was badly divided. It had no coherent stance, and spent as much time arguing amongst itself than presenting a coherent negotiating position. My sense, looking back, is that none of the parties were actually willing to enter into good faith negotiations, and that none of them were prioritizing the protection of the population of Darfur above their own sectional interests. I think they all thought at one stage or other that they could achieve more through force of arms than from negotiating, and all of them entered into negotiations with that at the back of their mind. There were, because of the geography of Darfur, relatively few military options in terms of peacekeeping or more coercive approaches to protection. It was simply not viable and feasible. And of course there was significant regional instability in terms of complicating factors in Chad, the Central African Republic, and elsewhere. And at the time, concerns about the wider splintering of Sudan. So, what are the key lessons? And I'll be very, very quick on the key lessons. I promise. Oh, geez. Okay, maybe I'll straight to... Basically, the key lesson is we need to implement the responsibility to protect. We need to translate this commitment into a living reality. And that means, in all of our organizations, we have to build atrocity prevention and the protection of populations from atrocities into our daily working practices. That means incorporating what I call, in other places, an atrocity prevention lens into our work. Thinking about whole of institution responses. How can our organization respond to protect populations from these crimes? Where are the sources of risk that need to be picked up, identified, and worked on early? Where are the patterns of local resilience that need to be supported and strengthened? And how can our organisations do this? And we need to build those habits of prevention from the top all the way down to the bottom and back up again. And I started with a quote from a UN Secretary General, and we'll end with one from the current UN Secretary General, which is that if someone hears their neighbour beating a child, they have a responsibility to intervene. It would be immoral and unacceptable to simply stand by knowing that child is being abused. R2P gives expression to a growing global conviction that it is immoral and unacceptable for states to commit or allow serious international crimes against their people. It holds the international community responsible for preventing and addressing these crimes. Protecting civilians from these atrocity crimes is a defining purpose of the UN in the 21st century. And I would suggest it should be a defining purpose of all of our organisations that work on these issues, and that it's one of the key lessons we should take from Darfur is that we've got to do more to translate those principles and commitments into daily lived reality. Thanks.
The next speaker is El Mahdi Abdul Rasool. He's a Sudanese refugee who arrived in Australia less than a year ago. He was chair of the Sudanese Organisation for Peace and Social Development and also the Deputy Secretary for Information for the Justice and Equality Movement, one of those groups in Darfur. He's a graduate of the University of Khartoum in Sudan and also the University of Cairo. He participated in the Darfur peace negotiations in Doha in 2010 and 11 that Alex referred to. So please welcome El Mahdi Abdul Rasool.
Hello, thank you very much. Sudan's Darfur crisis. Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Thanks to the great people of Australia and the Australian government, what they are doing in the areas of human rights. Thanks to Sudan Organization and Custom Center for Human Rights and the Sudan Peace Project for their interest in the issue of Sudan and for organizing this event today. 10 years on the genocide in Darfur. This year is 10th anniversary of the genocide in Darfur. Up till now, it is still the genocide continues in all even widened area and included other regions in South Sudan like the Nuba Mountains and Kordofan. The international community needs to be a major player in urging the UN Security Council and the UN to ensure that peace and security return to Sudan. As a recent member of the Sudan Security Council, the Australian government should take this opportunity and appeal to the UN Security Council in coordination with its partner in the Security Council to take a more decisive and urgent action on the government of Omar al-Bashir to accept a peaceful solution, comprehensive negotiation without conditions. Negotiation and parties agreement. There have been more than 10 years dialogue and negotiation with the regime in Sudan for peace, deals that have been deliberated of negotiation of insensitivity of the regime. The regime, if the genocide in Khartoum does not want political solution and only a military solution, which she lost in all the battles in Darfur as well as Kordofan and the Blue Nile, and the outcome of the negotiation with the government of al-Bashir today has been zero. I have been involved in peace negotiation in Darfur in Doha since February 2010 to 2011. During this period, found in all sincerity that Bashir government is unwilling to a peaceful solution, but is present in international conference more reasons and not to the solution the problem of Sudan in Darfur. In this Sudan and the Sudan Justice and Equality Movement, at this period has been signed framework agreement between the government of Sudan and the Sudan Justice and Equality Movement on 23 of February 2010, which encompassed all the demand of the people of Darfur and foremost an immediate ceasefire and the release of personnel and convict and security arrangement and the issue of displaced persons and refugees and the issue of the land and the sharing of power and wealth and the civil service as well as the chaos of justice and reconciliation and other issues. However, the tax Bashir government did not comply with it. The situation now in Darfur, very worse for women fighting in which the death toll in 4 months more than 1,000 dead civilians and more than 3,000 of displaced persons and refugees were insecurity, were even within large cities, and I plead with the Sudan government to provide support for these victims. I have two proposals. The international community must assume its responsibility in Sudan by clicking on the parties to accept a peaceful solution leading to the formation of a national transitional government involving all political forces without exception, provided that the peace, the place to negotiation and an Arab state. What is the role of the transitional government when resolving conflict regions so as to ensure their security and stability and secure their legitimate rights? 2, arrangement for the voluntary return for refugees and displaced persons to their place of origin. 3, conference regions of Sudan with the participation of all Sudanese political forces and civil society organizations and departments, eligibility and women, youth and student experts and those concerned with the Sudanese as West, as well as representatives of the inhabitants and discusses where all crisis regions of Sudan other and their relations with the center and the result of the conference of the recommendation and decision that are formulated in the constitution and seek open opinion of the people, then the people decided his fate. 4, conduct a comprehensive census. 5, a comprehensive preparation for election at all levels of local, state and federal. 2nd proposal is to support the Sudanese Revolutionary Forum and recognize as the legitimate representative of the people to the purpose of public the Bashir regime comprehensively is full coordination with the peaceful opposition according to a new down document which calls for the other through of the regime meeting between peaceful mass action and armed action, because the Sudanese Revolutionary Front now controls 27% of land in Sudan, in Darfur and Kordofan, Blue Nile, Appropriation Khartoum. We appeal to the Australian public and the government, please help bring peace to Sudan. We need peace building now in Sudan. Thanks.
Our final speaker is Aisha Mohammed, who experienced firsthand the horrors of the conflict in Darfur. Her family escaped to Egypt from Darfur and then moved to Australia 9 years ago. She feels strongly about the situation in Darfur and participates in programs where she can voice her opinion. Aisha is studying textile design at RMIT and is an advocate for peace in Darfur.
Hi everyone, my name is Aisha Mohammed and I'm a textile design student, as we just interviewed. Thank you all, everyone, for coming here today for this important day to our community as we are celebrating the 10th anniversary of Sudan. And we do appreciate them and for their support and their movement as they continue to support our movement to bring peace in Sudan. I have been in Australia for about 9 years. I'm originally from Darfur. My family and I were evacuated from Darfur in 2003 to Egypt as a result of the civil war. The duration of civil war, which forced us to evacuate for the sake of our safety. And at the time, I was 11 years old. As a child, I have witnessed the horror and the disturbing events which took place at shops, on the streets, in the villages. Which were caused by armed government militias and Janjaweed, who are Arab bandits. They have caused hundreds of cases of rape and killing innocent civilians, women and children from 2002 up until now. People have been living in subhuman conditions with misery and terror, fearing for their lives on a daily basis. Recently I went to Darfur in 2011 with my family to revisit and see how conditions have been with my family there. People still live in these very same conditions. Children are basically denied their rights to a happy, safe childhood, which I consider myself lucky in a way because I have experienced a bit of safe childhood at the time before this war. Women and children are the most vulnerable. Most of the men were killed, so women are basically left to look after their children and survive. There is a lack of assets such as food and shelter. And as much as I love Darfur, it is a place of my birth and where I experienced beautiful childhood, and that's basically the most memory I have as a child to keep that. It is no longer a safe, secure environment for people to live in. However, it must be improved. The children who are living there today, they are the next generation of Darfur. They do need support. They do need help. They have dreams, they have ambitions, which can only be achieved with assistance, such as a safe, secure environment, enough shelter, access, as well as education. It's very important. I consider myself one of the luckiest children of Darfur because I've been given a second chance to live with my entire family without having to lose my mom, my dad, or my sister or brother. My fear is to see Darfur remaining in these same conditions for the next decade to come. As a child, if you ask me if Darfur would someday experience such conditions as it is now, I'd probably deny that. I'd be like, no, there's no way that's going to happen. But it did occur, and it's not expected. I didn't expect it to be for this long, as it is a civil war, but it's been going on for 10 years. And it is affecting lives and people and the whole Darfur, basically. My wish is to see someday peace in my country. However, it will only be done with work, with assistance of Australian government and international interference to work together to bring peace to Darfur once again. Darfur is a peaceful country that has people loving and caring, and we have enough assets and everything. People are living safely, but now it's no longer safe, and it really does need assistance. I have experienced that as a child, and I've learned that in 2011 recently, and it's still going on, and it really does require help, and we would appreciate that. Thank you.
thanks very much to all three of you. We now do have some time for questions, so our speakers will be here on the panel. Janice is going to be coming around with a microphone. So if you put up your hands if you'd like to ask a question, and she'll try and get you in the right order. Just while we're waiting for the first question, I might just put one to Almaty if I can. You mentioned that, you know, one of the conditions that you want to see implemented from the peace agreement is a vote on the autonomy of Darfur. Considering the government of Sudan's sabotaging of the vote in Abyei, do you think there's any real likelihood that even if peace were to come to Darfur, that they would allow a vote to take place?
The government of Sudan, we negotiation with them more than 10 years, and the government has many military militias, Janjaweed and other joined African and other and Arab also, but unfortunately the government unknown and unable to do peace in Darfur and Kurdistan also and Brunei. Now rebels near Khartoum, maybe 300 kilometers near Khartoum. So the regimes in Sadri in Khartoum and Bashir wants ICC, but the international community no need, just making decision, but no anything to how to affect this decision. This is a big problem. The Syrian now, every time bombard, every time people kill. And we need help. We need international community to push the regime in Sudan to enable peace solution.
Okay, first question.
Two questions. Was there any reliable census material available at 2003? And if so, what was the approximate population of Darfur? And are there any means of income for the country apart from the oil?
Ask about population?
Population before 2003.
Yeah. People Darfur maybe at that time, I don't know exactly, but maybe more than 7 million, more than 7. Now, half of them outside Sudan, Chad, Central Africa, and Egypt, and other countries. Now, in main cities, Al-Fashir, like Al-Fashir, Niala, Jena, more of them stay in these places, but no one stay outside of these places. So exactly now, population of Sudan, the foreign inside Sudan may be less than 3 million, less than 3 million now.
The oil production, the only major means of production.
Oh, sorry. Darfur has many resources, uranium, oil, and other things. But now, the situation there is very terrible. Not secure. So we can government or rebels or many. Anyone who can make oil most difficult.
Hi, Ben Front.
Thank you. My question is to Professor Alec. My name is Maria Matia. I am a South Sudanese. But I have resided here in Australia for 6 years. I'm now studying a deacon, a postgraduate student. Professor, as you pointed before, that the primary ideal of R2P is basically based on a status for the people to protect their own people from ethnic cleansing and crime against humanity, and the incitement as well. If we go to the county in Darfur and the situation that is happening now in Syria, is R2P become a rhetoric that is actually promising real or do nothing to the people that are actually needing to be protected?
Thank you very much for that question. There are always going to be very, very difficult cases. I think Darfur is one. I think Syria is another. I think anyone looking at Syria who thinks there's an easy solution either doesn't fully understand what the situation in Syria is or is a bigger genius than I am. So there are always going to be those kind of cases where it's difficult to marshal consensus, where it's difficult to bring the parties together, and where it's difficult to bring the international community on board, both because of competing interests, but also because of some genuine differences of opinion about what the right course of action should be. But we shouldn't let those really hard cases mask the underlying trends. And the underlying trends are that there are fewer cases of atrocity crimes than there were 20, 30, 40 years ago. When those cases arise, fewer people on average tend to die. They tend to be shorter, less violent, and there tends to be more international response. And R2P is part of that equation of things changing. So during this 10 years, we've had, for example, the successful use of preventive diplomacy in Kenya. Just this year, there was an election in Kenya that was widely counted as being likely to trigger a new round of ethnic killing in Kenya. There was a large international effort to prevent that from happening, and touch wood, so far, that has succeeded. The UN mission in South Sudan is tasked with assisting the government in South Sudan to fulfill its responsibility to protect. Now, building a state from scratch is a huge undertaking, but I think those people that have spent more time in South Sudan than I have would see that there are signs of things improving, there are signs of capacities being built, and there's signs that those core institutions of protection are starting to arise after a context where there was, as you will know better than I, nothing before. In Mali, the UN and others are trying to assist the government there in protecting populations from Islamist radicals. In Yemen, responsibility to protect is used in the context of a negotiated transition of government. Of course, we all know about what happened with Libya, that I underscore, but when the Security Council authorized the use of force in Libya, there was a very real threat to the people of Benghazi. The head of state of Libya was calling them cockroaches, we all remember that language from Rwanda, and indicating very clearly what he intended to do with people. That didn't happen. Then, of course, in Cote d'Ivoire, we saw again the UN playing an active role in resolving a crisis that could have escalated very quickly into full-blown civil war. So, R2P is eight years old now. We're just at the start of trying to implement it. There is no sort of blueprint. Every situation is different. Sometimes it's going to be fairly successful, as in cases like Kenya. Other times, it's going to be very difficult. It's going to be very difficult to marshal that international opinion, to generate that will, to work out what the solutions are. Some people who are cleverer than I am talk about R2P as a responsibility to try. It's not always going to work. Protection is not always going to be complete. But if we can move the goalposts to a little step by step, we can get there. And I think it's really important that we don't sort of retreat to cynicism, because retreating to cynicism is taking a step back and allowing the kind of forces that drive atrocity crimes to claim the whole field. We've got to kind of keep challenging them and keep moving forward and keep holding ourselves to account for what we do.
Hi, I'm not quite sure who this question is for, perhaps Professor Bellamy. I was keen to hear about the supply of arms to the various parties that are doing all of the fighting, and it's quite well known that the US in particular produces more military weapons and more arms than anywhere else. Do you think that can be one of the reasons why they're hesitant to become involved?
Yeah. You know, the US, the US on arms is bizarre, and I've tried to understand it, and I still don't understand it. Yeah, this whole thing of, you know, it's not guns that kill people, it's people that kill people. But they seem to fail to understand that people with guns kill lots of people. I don't. Sometimes those relationships influence how states respond to crises. I don't think it's the monetary value of the arms themselves. Usually the flow of arms reflects existing political loyalty. So, for example, you know, the thing that everyone's talking about today is the Russia-Syria. It's not the case that Russian policy on Syria is driven by its sale of a few arms. It's simply not that significant. But the sale of arms reflects those underlying trends. I think the thing for the US in relation to Darfur was, firstly, it was fixated on the Comprehensive Peace Agreement between the government of Sudan and the SPLA. Secondly, within the Pentagon, there was a sense that Khartoum was fairly useful in relation to the war on terror and deep reluctance. So we know, for example, that people indicted by the ICC were given trips to Washington on US government planes to negotiate with the US government and pass on information about the war on terror. So I think those are the things driving US policy, and that's distorted US policy for the whole of the Horn of Africa as well. I mean, US policy on Somalia has been equally blinkered by that. So I think it's those kind of underlying interests rather than necessarily the flow of arms. The tragedy is there is already, you know, the continent is awash with arms. A lot of the arms that flows into Darfur, and I'm not an expert on this, but are second and third hand arms. So they're not new, but they're being rerouted, particularly through countries like Chad and Libya, of course, was a key supporter. The government of Sudan has always been able to source arms from the open market. There was a time when it was able to do so. Open at the beginning of the conflict, it had no embargo upon it. There were some member states that were reluctant to see and implement an embargo, China being one, of course. But that's slowly changed. But the government has no shortage of weapons and huge stockpiles. The flow of arms from other parts of the region does inflame things. And what it does, and again this kind of goes to current debates about Syria, what it does is it creates beliefs among the armed groups that they can prevail through violence. Whilst they're getting those arms, they think that they can get a better deal by continuing to fight. And this I think applies for, you know, clearly for the government, but for some of the other parties as well. That's why arms embargoes properly implemented can be effective in changing those calculations and bringing parties to realise that you can't solve this through violence. You have to at some point sit down and negotiate. And unfortunately, the flow of arms just makes that impossible.
Okay. Thank you. My question actually goes to Professor Lex. Call me Madin. Actually living in Australia for the last 6 years, originally from South Sudan. I'm doing my postgrad in Deakin right now. My question is, given that you are aware of the human rights, because you have already done more research about it, is that the right for the chief government or regime in Khartoum to declare jihad against the people of Darfur and other areas in Sudan like Blue Nile, source called the Pan, or is it the right that people whom the jihad had been declared against them to be protected by the United Nations?
Thanks very much. On the side of the right of the governments have responsibilities to protect their populations. The head of state of Sudan is indicted for crimes for which I am convinced he would be found guilty were he to find dead in court. One of the things that one of the signs of progress is that the long arm of the law is starting to reach people. So, you know, we've seen recently former head of state of Guatemala be convicted of genocide. It's got to be retried, but nevertheless, he's in court on those charges.
many years after he stepped down, I think that one day the long arm of the law will reach Omar al-Bashir as well. So he has no right to do what he does. He's violating drafts of international law, as well as Sudanese law as well. That's the other thing to bear in mind. He's violating his own constitution and his own laws that have done systematically for decades. Do groups have a right to protect themselves? Yes. And they have a right to expect that the international community will do what it can to protect. What we need to do is think more thoroughly about what protection entails, what sorts of capabilities are needed. Clearly, 21,000 relatively lightly armed peacekeepers cannot protect everyone in a region the size of Western Europe. We need to think about those sorts of things. We need to think about policing. For a lot of the period in the last 5 or 6 years, the key protection challenges have come from issues about an absence of the rule of law and an absence of policing. Yet policing and its role in protection is one we've barely started to think about. So I think where we are internationally is we have the agreement on the principle. Nobody now disputes the principle. But we're only just starting to think about what that means in terms of implementation. And those are difficult questions in themselves. So keep studying it deep in, and I look forward to hearing your answers and thoughts on all of that.
We've just got time for one more question.
Hi. I'm Dean. I'm the campaign director of the City and Peace Project, so I thank all of you for speaking here tonight. My question is for Professor Bellamy. We know that Australia has a unique and rare opportunity now that we're on the Security Council. What realistic opportunity do we actually have in effecting change in the Security Council? And if so, is it through what practical implications is it? Is it through sanctions? Is it through enforcement of resolution? What's realistic and what can actually be done?
Good question. Okay, from past experience of when interested non-permanent members of the Security Council have been there, what have they been able to achieve? Well, there's a bunch of things they can do. Firstly, they can push one thematic issue. So, for example, Canada in 1999-2000 pushed the protection of civilians, and as a result of kind of doing that systematically, twice a year the Council comes down and sits and talks about protection of civilians issues. And those issues have found their way into peacekeeping mandates. So when we talk about underlying change, 20 years ago, no UN peacekeeping operations had protection of civilians mandate. Even a mission called the UN Protection Force did not have a mandate to protect civilians. Now, I think 15 or 17 missions do. So 100,000 UN peacekeepers operating right now around the world have protection of civilians mandates. And that was largely, not wholly, but largely to do with what the Canadians did. The other thing that the Canadians were able to do is interesting, you talk about sanctions, is they work with the Council to strengthen its working processes on sanctions committees. In particular, tightening up the way that the Council reviews and examines sanctions and making sure that those sanctions are properly implemented. One of the interesting things that came out of both Libya and Cote d'Ivoire, and that hasn't been commented on very much, is the role of targeted financial sanctions, in particular asset freezes in both of those situations. What happened in both of those cases, in the case of Cote d'Ivoire, was ECOWAS, who imposed targeted freezes of Laurent Gbagbo's money. What that meant was that he couldn't pay his civil servants, couldn't pay his soldiers, and as soon as he stopped being able to pay people, suddenly support melted away. And that's precisely what happened in Libya as well. As soon as Gaddafi was unable to pay people, support melted away. So one of the lessons is the international community can get better at targeted financial sanctions against key individuals, it can have fairly dramatic effects on their capacity to influence other people. And in terms of what Australia can do, my wife and colleague knows more about these things than I do, is arguing that Australia should press the case for every UN mission to have a gender protection advisor in them. Some missions do. Some missions don't, but they're ad hoc and they're funded by voluntary contributions from member states rather than through the regular UN budget. She argued that one small thing Australia could do is persuade the Security Council to authorise these positions in all of the UN's peacekeeping and political missions to ensure that gender mainstreaming and the protection of women and children get put at the fore of every mission the UN does and not just selectively. That's a fairly small step. for what I think is achievable. I think that Central Australia has a strong track record on these issues, could push for, and is one that is likely to have all sorts of knock-on consequences. The other thing that Australia can do, and this comes back to the issue of arms, is of course one of the great achievements of this year has been the Arms Trade Treaty. The Arms Trade Treaty, amongst other things, said the state shouldn't sell arms to other governments that it suspects are likely to commit genocide and other atrocity crimes. The big question is, how is that going to be monitored and enforced? And is there a role for the Security Council in monitoring and enforcing that? And one thing that the Australia could do is to suggest that what in US think is an informal discussion of the Security Council to talk about what the Council could do to ensure compliance with that aspect of the Arms Trade Treaty. And again, if that one aspect becomes part of the kind of lived reality, day-to-day reality, but it becomes harder for governments intent on committing genocide and atrocity crimes to buy weapons, that in itself will make a difference. And because Australia plays such a key role in negotiating the ATT, chairing the final negotiations, again, this is something that I think Australia could meaningfully lead on in the Council in the next 18 months.
Great. Just before I finish, I want to pick up on a couple of things you said, Alex. one thing you quoted Kofi Annan on the failure to protect in Darfur. Whenever I hear Kofi speak about things like that, I think of his senior role in the UN at the time of the Rwandan genocide. You also mentioned Kenya, and certainly the international community played a role there, but what was also very significant there was the iron will of the Kenyan people to make sure that that didn't happen again. So, in every case, whether it's successful or not, we have an international community that either acts or doesn't, and a local community that must also be willing to act. And in Darfur at the moment, we arguably have neither. So I'd like to thank our panel for a fantastic discussion tonight, and it's great to have a panel with three such very different points of view. I'd like to thank the Darfur Australia Network and the Sudan Peace Project for co-hosting tonight. And I'd like to thank all of you for coming out on a very cold, wet night. I'm really impressed with the percentage turnout that we've managed to get tonight. So finally, if you could join me in thanking our speakers.